Hi, my name's Tony Vinciguerra. I'm a senior manager of technical writing at athenahealth. athenahealth is a SaaS company, software as a service. It provides billing, medical record, and network services to hospitals and doctor's offices. Matt, you can sit right up front here if you want. Can I see a show of hands? How many people were at yesterday's Holy Grail session? Wow. We have a lot of repeat offenders here. Okay. We're going to have to bear. Wow. Thank you. Okay. Well, you're going to have to bear with me because about half of you did not raise your hands, so I'm going to have to fill in those folks on some of this stuff that I talked about yesterday, so my apologies for the repetition here. Okay, so what the hell is the Holy Grail of documentation? Okay, so about a year and a half ago, I was looking for a way to quantify good documentation, not just qualify it. Qualifying it would be saying like, oh, it's grammatically correct and it's concise and it's accurate and so on and so forth, right? I'm looking for a way to quantify it. Could we put some numerical value next to what good documentation is? So I called about a dozen, actually it was exactly a dozen doc managers around the country, and I said, do you measure readership? And if you do, do you compare like the readership of your online help to calls to customer support? And you know, do you measure readership of your release documentation? Do you compare that to people actually using the features that the documentation is talking about? And they all said no. Some of them were measuring readership, but they never took it beyond that. And the last guy I talked to, he said, you know, wow, if you could show that your online help was reducing calls to customer support, or you could show that your release documentation was increasing usage of the features, that's the Holy Grail. So I stole his phrase, and I've been looking for it ever since. So there are the two halves right there. So on the left, case deflection, that's a support catchphrase for preventing people from calling customer support, right? And on the right, feature adoption, more of a marketing term of, you know, people using whatever it is you're writing about, in our case, release documentation. So for the roughly half of you that were not at yesterday's session, first of all, shame on you. No, I'm just kidding. I know I was up against Scott Deloche. Those are big guns to fight. If I were you, I would have gone to see Scott, too. I always go to all his sessions. I was sorry that he was at the same time as me yesterday. So yesterday's session was about that first half of the Holy Grail that you saw on the left side of the previous screen. So I shared with the audience, you know, some data that I gathered on readership of my team's online help, and then I gathered data from our customer support department, and I was actually able to look user to user. Did user X, did Jane Doe read an online help topic, and then did she pick up the phone and call customer support about the same content that was in that help topic or not? And I was actually able to put a dollar figure around that and show some real strong correlations. Due to legal reasons and because we are in the healthcare space, I wasn't able to get the okay to suppress readership to a subset of my online help to create a control group and scientifically prove causation. But the correlation was strong enough to get a lot of really cool stuff written in my annual review. So we'll leave it at that. So you know the recording's available. Slides are already available right on the app. Matt just showed me on my team here. Showed me you can just email them to yourself right now. Okay, since this session is about releases, release documentation, I thought I'd let you know what we do at athenahealth for release documentation. It's not exactly standard. This is my seventh tech writing job. I've been at Athena for 10 years now, so I am old. And so this is what we do for release documentation at athenahealth for reasons I won't get into now, but if you have questions, by all means, ask away. So we have about 8,000 clients across those 8,000 client sites around the U.S. We're only U.S.-based. We have about 300,000 users, almost exactly right now. There's just one version of our software. It's that single-instance, multi-tenant software you hear sales guys talk about. We have three big releases a year. We also have these little bi-weekly releases in between. We write about 700 pieces of release documentation a year. We call them release notes. I put that in quotes because it's not that industry standard release note that you're used to seeing probably as a technical writer. There's a screenshot on the right there. So that looks like online help, doesn't it? It looks, that's Flare's HTML5 tri-pane output with a couple of tables of contents in there. And that's what our release documentation looks like, a big, long form. Like, I mean, each one of those topics could be up to 27 pages long. You know, we'll have 100 of them in a release or more. So it's real long-form release documentation. Our users don't have access to our system because it's cloud-based single instance, remember. They don't have access to it until that new functionality, until the day we switch it on. And so they're kind of flying blind up to that point. So they need us, the technical writing team at Athena Health, to provide them with as much information in advance as we can. So we publish this 3 weeks prior to release day. So it's, think of it that way, real, like basically online help for a release. We publish directly into the code base. That's very important. That's going to come up a lot during my presentation. That means our users have to log into our software in order to access the release documentation. We have 9 full-time people doing nothing but writing those 700 release notes a year. We have a 14-person team total. Okay, a few caveats about today's presentation. It's going to be very different than yesterday's. Yesterday's was very much a how-to. You know, I had a lot of success with, you know, showing that we drive down support calls with our online help. I have not had quite so much success with this one. I've had a little bit, and I'm happy to share all my failures and successes. So this is not a case, I'm sorry, this is a case study. This is not a how-to. It's more of a how-not-to. I'm hoping you can learn from my mistakes and do better stuff. I am like Lewis and Clark in that I don't have a map that I'm following. I'm drawing the map as I go on this journey. Okay. So why, you might be thinking, I certainly had this thought, why would you want to do this? Why would you want to try readership of your release documentation to usage of the features that are being written about? Well, first of all, it came from the top down. Management was very interested in it. So the tech writing team at Athena Health reports into product marketing. And so they're all hot about adoption of features. They like to use that word a lot, mostly because they want our clients to see the value of what we're offering them so they don't leave us and go to one of our competitors, first of all. Second of all, so that the, you know, they're happy with what we have and they're using it the way that we use it, so that we're investing money in the right places. So I've been working on this project for over a year, year and a half almost. And so we had 2 people from Athena Health go to Mad World last year, and I asked them, like, hey, when you go to Mad World, ask around, is anybody else doing anything like this? And so they asked everybody they could talk to about that, and of course everybody said no, why would you do that? But actually a lot of them said, that's really interesting though, I would love to see a presentation on that. So here I am. So another reason to do it is, I feel like there's really no risk in doing this. Like if I fail, I fail. Like I'm not going to lose my job over it, I hope. And there's a lot of big potential gains. Like I said, we could be spending our money in the right places as a company if we know that what features people are using and what they're not using. And if we could encourage them to use stuff that we're putting out based on what we write. And if I do that, that would help prove the value of all this release documentation that we're producing, which would in turn get a lot of recognition for the team, and you know, would help out in staffing needs when I have those conversations about budgets, and could boost my career. Has not done that yet. All right. So, of course, encouraging people to use functionality is not the number one goal of release documentation, right? It's to prevent people from picking up the phone and calling customer support every time you release a new version of your software. You release some new feature, you don't want everybody freaking out and flooding customer support with calls, like they did in November of 2017. that was a rough release. A lot of reasons behind that. Again, I won't spend a lot of time on explaining why, but I'm happy to answer questions later. In any case, when we saw how rough that was, we, and when I say we, I mean actually Samantha Barney sitting here in the front, surveyed all of our clients and said, hey, what can we do with our release documentation to make it more useful for you? So we made a ton of changes to our documentation. I'm going to show you a couple of examples to help meet their needs more. And as you can see, the calls to customer support, you know, went to a nice low level after that. In 2017, we released a lot of optional features that not a lot of people used. We found out later that there really wasn't a lot of usage there, and we thought, boy, we really wasted a lot of money as a company because we built all this stuff and we created all this documentation and training around that stuff, and people just didn't use it. They did, but not as much as we would have liked. And that's why my boss and his boss were so keen on this whole adoption thing. So I thought, I asked the question, could our documentation help in other ways? It's helping, I think it seems to be, there's a nice strong correlation between the changes we're making with our documentation and a reduction in calls to support. Could it maybe help with adoption too? So is it an option? All right, so what do we mean by adoption? My simple definition is just basically you want the user to use the feature you put out in the way that you intended them to use it. So an example at Athena Health would be we have clients who are billers at doctor's offices, and they're submitting claims to insurance companies to, in hopes of getting reimbursed for services that someone at their office provided. And they might need to add some documentation, attach that to that claim as they send it to the insurance company. So we would build a feature that helps them do that. Instead of having to mail the claim manually, they could just attach it right in our software and send it off, right? So we have, there's a feature I'll talk about throughout this presentation called this add attachments feature, this claim action add attachments feature. So that would be an example. So who defines what adoption is for each feature? Well, it's company policy that the scrum teams that build the feature define adoption. And the guidance is that those scrum teams should be defining adoption for every feature they build and measuring that. It's just guidance. They're not really held accountable for it yet. It's a new thing that they just started doing last year. We, as a team, started the technical writers, the 14 of us, well, the 9 release writers, started adding value statements to our documentation. So I know you can't read that, and it's the text itself is not that important. I'll explain what it is. At the bottom, we have a couple of quotes from beta users of this feature, and this is a screenshot from a very long release note that was many pages long. But at the top, and this is not the very top of it, but you know, below the meat of it, we had some of this data that we thought might help people, our users, see the value of this feature and want to use it. So we said, you know, hey, in the beta phase, 95% of users saw this benefit and 99% saw this benefit. And down below, we have a couple of quotes from beta users saying that they, you know, the value that they found in this feature. So we were hoping if we started doing that, maybe we could start to see even a stronger correlation between readers of our documentation and usage of the feature. So the goal of this project, when I started off, was very simple. I just wanted to answer the question, if someone reads the documentation, are they more likely to use that feature or not? Even a no answer would be success. If I showed strongly that there's no correlation there, so be it. So that's what I set out to do. So give you a little sneak peek. I'm going to need to set a lot of context for you, and I appreciate your patience with that, but this, otherwise the math would make no sense to you whatsoever. But this is the kind of stuff I'm going to be showing you later on. I looked at 3 different features, and for each feature, I compared data of what we call adoption, usage of the feature, and correlated with reading the release note that was written about that, the release documentation that we wrote. So that's what we'll get to. So at a high level, this is what I tried to do over the past year plus. First, I went around, we have over 100 scrum teams at Athena Health, and I tried to find those ones that were defining and measuring adoption of these features that they were releasing. And then I would try to gather the adoption data that they were hopefully gathering on that feature, if it fit the bill. And in my next slide, I'll explain what I mean by that. Then I tried to define our target audience. I said we have 300,000 users. I also said we service doctor's offices and hospitals, right? Well, we service doctor's offices that might have one doctor, and then we service doctor's offices that have thousands of doctors and hospitals of, you know, various sizes and so on and so forth, and every specialty under the sun. So clearly, there are very few features in our software that all 300,000 of our users would ever use or have any need to use. So you need to define who's your target audience there. Otherwise, your math is going to be totally screwed up, right? So then, of course, you have to measure readership. That goes without saying. And then I'm looking for a correlation there. And then if I can do that with one feature, and I can lather, rinse, repeat, and scale. So the ideal feature, I said earlier, if the feature fits the bill. So when I started on this project, I thought, I just need to find the optional features we're releasing, and I'll just do my thing. I'll just go through all the stuff I just showed you I was going to go through with all the optional features. Well, I quickly learned that just because it's optional, that doesn't mean it really fits the needs of what I was looking for in this project. I also needed to find a feature that had a consistent use case. I didn't realize this. This was quite a learning experience. We actually have a lot of features where people can use them in different ways. We have features that claim actions add attachments feature. I'll talk more about this, but it turns out people can use it manually or they can automate it. And when they automate it, the way I was measuring it and the way the Scrum team was measuring it, it looks like people weren't using it at all. It looks like they weren't adopting it. Of course, they were using it, but it was all automated. Ideally, features generally available. If I tried to do this, I'll show you the example. I tried to do this with a beta feature, and that was problematic for multiple reasons, which I'll get into. Generally available feature, much better, because first of all, you're releasing it to a lot more people, which means you have a lot more data to work with. Big Bang release, I learned the hard way, is very much ideal for this scenario. I found out with one of the features that there was a long, slow rollout of the feature across our user base. And that made it really hard to figure out when to start and stop measuring adoption data and readership data. And as part of that long rollout, our clients were getting the documentation in different ways. They weren't just accessing that HTML5 output I showed you a screenshot of earlier. Their account managers were creating PDFs and emailing it to people, and of course I had no way of tracking that readership. And ideally you want a large, well-defined target audience. Large so that you have, again, a lot of data and you can show statistical significance. Well-defined meaning, does this only apply to cardiologists? Does this apply to, you know, all the billers across, you know, all our 300,000 users? Or is it only the billers that work in, you know, this particular specialty or these particular specialties, that kind of thing? Is it all nurses, that kind of thing? So sometimes that was a little more difficult than I would have liked to admit. So the challenges I ran into were I found out that in our highly regulated industry, we actually release very few optional features. And measuring adoption of a mandatory feature, well, that's kind of stupid. I didn't do that. So yeah, there weren't a lot of optional features to choose from. I literally could count them on one hand, actually. So you'll see I went through three of them, and I'll do that. Like I said, the Scrum teams just had guidance. They weren't mandated to define and measure adoption. So not all of them were doing it. And it wasn't for lack of trying. In some cases, they just couldn't. They just didn't have the instrumentation in place. But some were, luckily. And some were gathering data but weren't able to share the source data with me. They were storing it in some code base somewhere, and they're like, I don't even know how to get this to you. And I'm like, so it was a little tough. So what do I mean by clean data? That's a term I made up, I think. I've never heard it any other ways. So clean data, what I mean by that, and I'll get into some specific examples when I show you the features. But clean data would be data that you capture right at the source. Right when someone uses a feature, you capture that and say, aha, I have an adopter. So right when someone reads your documentation, you say, aha, I have a reader. But as it turns out, due to the tools I was able to use for this project, I was capturing data far downstream. I was digging into an index and there were a lot of links in the chain, and some of those links could break from time to time. There were web services that were running, there were databases that were running, and sometimes they'd stop running for a second or two, and I would lose some data. So that was one way. I got really tired of hearing this phrase. I talked to a lot of Scrum teams, and I think I heard this sentence verbatim at least three times. But I mean, you know, they were empathetic. They're like, geez, this project sounds really cool, but this might not be the feature for you. And it was because of all those reasons I had listed above. All right, I showed this graphic yesterday. So for those of you that were not here yesterday, how many have seen this graphic before? All right, wow, a lot. See, yesterday we had 40 people in the room and not a single person had seen this graphic before. So I first saw this in the Lean Startup. This is called the MVP graphic, the Minimum Viable Product graphic. If you Google that, you will find many different variations of it. I love this graphic because it's just so clear looking at it, right? You don't want to give your users something useless that they can't use at all until 2 years down the road you finally hand them a sports car. You know, you give them a skateboard, and at least they can still get from point A to point B, and then you can add handlebars to it, you can add gears to it, and eventually you're going to get them a sports car. But they've had something to use all along the way, right? So I mentioned in yesterday's presentation, I started off with the top part of this graphic. I tried to boil the ocean. I tried to build a sports car from the get-go, and I failed miserably. And I quickly learned I better go back and just build a skateboard and then build off from that. And I did, and I had some pretty good success doing that. So when I started this project, I said, I'm just going to build a skateboard. I'm just going to find one feature at one point in time and see if I can measure readership for that documentation and measure adoption for that one feature. And if I can pull that off, I can just manually gather that data, see if there's any correlation there. Then I can build off of that. I do it for a few features, and I've got myself a scooter. And then if I do it for a bunch of features over a bunch of points in time instead of just at one release, for example, you know, now I've got myself a bicycle. And then if I can start to automate some of this stuff, instead of me going and manually pulling this data, if I could get some of that data fed to me, fed into a dashboard, for example, or something, now I've got myself a motorcycle. And then if I can replicate that motorcycle across, you know, all of the optional features that we're releasing, all five of them that we release every year, now I've got myself a sports car. But I didn't get that far, but I had some success. All right, yesterday I showed a slide very similar to this one, and this is very true with this project as well. I needed a lot of help. So We had a few folks writing the release documentation, of course. We're very lucky at Athena Health, for now at least. We have this great team of analytics managers that work very closely with the Scrum teams, and they define adoption and they measure adoption. So I'm going to be talking about them quite a bit. I had our newest tech writer, Fran, help me gathering and crunching some data and all that stuff, being a full-time tech writer and doc manager. I have a team of people I manage. You know, I didn't have a lot of time to invest in this project, so I got the go-ahead to hire a part-time contractor, Daniel. I'll be mentioning Daniel from time to time throughout this presentation as well. He could not have done this without him. He did a ton of work on all this stuff, gathering data, researching tools, crunching numbers, creating dashboards. He did it all. We also have a team at Athena Health that I will mention with one of the features in particular, that manages all of our alphas and betas. They actually manage the rollouts of those alphas and betas. They find the clients to participate in the alpha process, beta process, and all that. So Karthi is on that product operations team. And then finally, my Italian friend Pier Paolo is a mathematician, and I am the opposite of a mathematician, like I said yesterday. And so he helped me. I literally sent him an email. The subject was, is this even mathematically possible? Big question mark. And so he helped me figure out all the math that you're going to see in this presentation. So I will be talking about him. All right, what tools did I use? Well, I used the tools that we already had available at Athena Health. We had an Elasticsearch engine, and we use Kibana, which is a free open source tool that helps you peek into that Elasticsearch index. And I used Tableau as my analytics tool. And I will explain what each of these are in case anybody's not familiar, because we already had a license in-house that, and it was being used by other teams. All right, so Elasticsearch, for those that aren't familiar with it, it is a search engine. It's like Google, except it's on, you know, it's typically on-premise. You can use a cloud version as well, but it's only for your company. It's not like Google where you're searching the whole world. So we have an Elasticsearch engine at Athena Health that our development teams use to track all sorts of stuff in our software. So anytime anybody clicks anything in our software, does anything, it's tracked and it's logged in this giant index that in our Elasticsearch engine. So you remember at the beginning of the presentation, I said that our release documentation is embedded in our software and that users have to log in to access it. That means when they click on a piece of release documentation, it's logged in this Elasticsearch engine. So that's where I could see that, and I could see their username and what client they were with, and I could find out all sorts of great info on who they were and when they looked. So this is awesome for our HTML5 output, which is, like I said, embedded in our source code. And it gets me great individual user data. Useless for our print output because we serve that up through our community site. or, like I said, account managers email it off to alpha clients, beta clients, and all that. The downside to Elasticsearch, at least in our instance, and I think in most instances, is that it can't store data for very long because it's storing just such vast pools of information. Like I said, every single click in our software, 300,000 users using it every single day. So we have a company policy, and I've been told that most companies have a policy similar to this, where we delete anything that's older than 4 months. Like I said, we have 3 releases a year. That means if I want to look back 2 releases, I'm out of luck. That data's gone. So I have to capture it when I can and save it in other ways. Lastly, the other final con of using Elasticsearch in our instance is that at least I couldn't figure out a way to see how long someone was looking at our documentation. Remember I said our documentation is like long form online help essentially for the release. Well, if someone clicked on it and immediately clicked away and didn't even read a word of it, to me that looks the same as someone who spent an hour, you know, pouring through it. I can't see the length of time they were sitting there on the page. It's not an analytics tool, it's a search tool. You know, it's like using a hammer instead of a screwdriver. Tableau, so it's an analytics tool. It is like Microsoft Excel on steroids. You can take all sorts of data from all sorts of places, throw it in there, and it'll compare it like it's apples to apples. It's really, really great tool. It can create some really cool visualizations. It is expensive, and there is a steep learning curve because it's such a cool tool. So I use this to, when I got all that data through the Elasticsearch engine, I would feed it into here. And when I got data from the Scrum teams on adoption, I would feed it into here, and this would help me analyze that. All right, so what did all this cost me? In case you're curious, if you're thinking about following in my footsteps, or at least learning from my mistakes, this is what you might expect to pay. So I talked about Daniel, the part-time contractor. So he worked about 20 hours a week for me on average. So, you know, I paid him the going hourly rate and in our area in Boston. So he helped me do research on tools, gathering data, crunching numbers. I said that Tableau is expensive, and it is, $840 a year per person. For the desktop license, that's where you use that to create the visualizations. If you're just a viewer, it doesn't cost anything. Elasticsearch engine, our company, I don't know what we spent on it, but on the Elasticsearch website, it's anywhere from $1,200 to $12,000 a year. That's just for the software. Then, as you see in the next line, you have to have hardware to host that software on if you're going to have it on premise. And, you know, you need to have databases and all that stuff. So you'd have to talk to your IT department about what that might run you. Kibana is an open source freeware tool that you can use to look at your Elasticsearch engine, peek into the index and all that. Normally you would put your lessons learned at the end of your presentation, but I realized as I did some dry runs of this that people had no idea what I was talking about. So I needed to move this a lot earlier to understand some of the challenges that, you know, I'm going to get into when I get to my examples, which are coming right up next. You're going to need to know some of this stuff, this one point in particular. So one thing we learned over the course of the last year is that maybe as many as 80% of our clients use a release trainer model. That means that not all of those 300,000 users go to our community site and download, or into our software and download our release documentation and all the other release information that we make available. Usually one person does. You know, we have clients that have literally 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 users at them. And one person will go get the release documentation, and then they'll turn around and they'll reformat that documentation into some slideshow or something, and they'll have a big meeting like this, and they'll teach, hey, this is what's coming up in Athena Health's new release in 3 weeks. They'll teach it back to the rest of the organization. So from my perspective, it looks like one person read the documentation and only one person was actually, you know, maybe willing to go and use that feature. When in reality, it was thousands of people, but just one viewer that I could see. So we had all these secondary viewers. So I quickly realized, unlike in yesterday's presentation when I was talking about online help, I could look at, did Jane Doe look at the online help, and then did Jane Doe call customer support? I can't do that with the release documentation. Instead, I have to look organization to organization. So now, instead of 300,000 users, I'm looking at 8,000 practices or offices or hospitals, whatever the case may be, organizations. So now I have to ask myself the question this way. Did anyone from organization A read the release documentation? And then did anyone else from organization A or that person go and use the feature? So it's a very important point. So I'm going from 300,000 to 8,000 as my potential pool. That means much smaller data sets. That means it's going to be much harder to show statistical significance. So says my mathematician friend, Pier Paolo. Again, lack of clean data. So I talked about the links in the chain earlier. That was one way that some of my data felt dirty to me. Another way is that there were sometimes it was unclear who the target audience was. There was discrepancies. So I would, when I first would go to the Scrum team and say, who is this feature for that you're releasing? And they would say, oh, it's for all the billers. At anyone who's, you know, at some hospital, excuse me, at some doctor's office, any biller that works at a doctor's office, this is for them, you know. And then later, after we went and measured all the data, we would learn, and we got feedback through account management and customer service and all that, we'd realize, oh, wait a minute, it wasn't actually for everyone. As it turns out, you know, a lot of billers that work at really large practices, they just automate this. They just pay to have this automated, and so they're, we were measuring them as potential users of the feature, but they never even had a need to use the feature. They weren't actually potential users of the feature. So it threw off some of our data, made our data unclean, shall I say. I mentioned earlier different types of releases, beta releases, all that means smaller users. It also means different documentation delivery methods. Like I said, the account managers might email a PDF. I can't measure readership of that. And then I already told you about not capturing data at the source. I'm pulling it from the Elasticsearch engine repository, right, from that index, which is way down the chain of events from when people are actually taking the action that we're looking to measure. So, you know, if I had infinite money to spend on this project, I could have bought some really cool, fancy tools that would help me actually capture the data right when it was happening. But I was using the tools I had laying around the house. All right, so I did capture some data, and I captured some okay data and some good data in some cases. These are the three features. I already told you about claim action add attachments, someone adding an attachment to a biller usually, right? Adding an attachment to something that they're sending off to an insurance company to get reimbursed for a service that someone at their office provided. So that's the first feature that I'll go through. Then there's this nursing flow sheets feature. Nursing flow sheets, as the name implies, helps nurses, document patients' conditions on the fly, right in their chart, right in our software as they're working with that patient. Prescription drug monitoring, this is a report that, and Maureen, correct me if I'm wrong here, she wrote that. Prescription drug monitoring report can track any prescription for a controlled substance that the patient filled anywhere in the state at any pharmacy, any doctor's office, right? Okay, so that's what that is. So the opioid crisis, of course, made this a really in-demand feature, but an optional feature. All right, claim actions add attachments feature. So good news is, had that dedicated analytics manager, I showed you pictures earlier of those three guys. So this one was David, and he was defining and measuring adoption, and he was able to share his data with me, which was great. The bad news is there was a wide range of users that were, you know, using it in different ways. You see this phrase, barriers to adoption. This is what happens when you work in a marketing department. You use phrases like barriers to adoption. so this is essential. Again, this was the feature where people could automate it. If they had enough money, this is some big client of ours that had deep pockets, they could just pay to have some script built that would just automate this. And so we were measuring their usage or non-usage of it as potential adopters, and it turns out they had no need to use this feature. There was another barrier to adoption, and that was you only need to use this feature if you screw up the first time. If you send off the claim to the insurance company and you already have the stuff attached, you don't even need to use this feature, and your claim's accepted, and you're fine. It's only if it gets kicked back to you is when you need to use the feature that we built. So it's really for the people that don't know what they're doing. All that led to some Swiss cheese data. All right, here's what some of the data looked like. The raw numbers are really low, which, again, made it hard to show statistical significance. But here are some of the percentages, you know. So the good news is our smallest clients, which makes up the largest portion of our client base, we have a lot of small 1, 2, 3-doc practices that are clients of ours. And actually, their readership of our documentation is a lot lower than it is at the bigger practices, which is a problem we're looking to solve this year. But the good news is 54% of them that read this document did use the feature, which is great. The bad news is that across our whole client base, it looked like 27%, you know, of those that read the document actually used the feature. So a very low number there. All right, I'm going to get into the math around that soon, but let me explain each of the three features first so you understand a little bit of where I'm coming from with this. So nursing flow sheets, again, this is where nurses are documenting patients' conditions right in the patient chart, right? So the good news with this feature, again, I had a dedicated analytics manager that I could work with. I wasn't working with a scrum master who was kind of doing this off the side of her desk or something like that. And Vince, the manager, he did define and measure adoption. And he was able to share his data with me, even his raw data, which was great. The bad news is the audience for this was 92 small hospitals, rural hospitals around the U.S. So a super small data set because, again, I'm looking organization to organization, not user to user. So that means my biggest denominator is 92. So it's going to be rough to show statistical significance when you're starting with a number that small as your largest potential denominator. Barriers to adoption, again, there's that lovely marketing phrase. Here, the barrier to adoption, I didn't find out until well after the fact, when I was working with Karthi, who I showed you in the previous slide, and our product operations team. I went to talk to her at one point because I knew that she managed the rollout of the beta of this feature. And I said, hey, this thing's GA, and I'm having trouble figuring out, like, who's using the feature, who's not, who's reading the documentation, who's not. And she said, oh, we had a big, long rollout of this feature. In beta, and account managers were emailing PDFs of the release documentation to the users. I'm like, oh, that's why it looks like nobody's reading it. Also, she said, we just recently found out that some hospitals actually have a policy in place that forbid the nurses from using this flow sheet feature. They're supposed to use something called shift notes instead. Don't ask me what that is. But it means they're literally forbidden from using this feature. Like, oh, that would have been really good to know before I started measuring adoption of it. So do not try to read or interpret this screenshot. That's just to show you that the analytics manager was really dedicated to this. He created this crazy dashboard, which I couldn't make heads or tails of either. But it was really cool because I could sit down with him and he could explain to me, oh, this was the date that they used it, and this was the date that they had 100% adoption, and this was the date they read your document. And it was really cool. He was a great guy, but unfortunately the bad news is only 42% of people that read the documentation adopted it, and 58% did not. Like I said, the ugly part at the bottom here, we were counting people that couldn't adopt it, and we didn't even know that at the time. So that really threw off our numbers. All right, let's talk about this prescription drug monitoring feature. We call it PDMP for short, for prescription drug monitoring program. Again, this is that report that shows when folks fill a prescription for a controlled substance anywhere within the state. And that means even if they fill it at a pharmacy, at their doctor's office, whatever, it's going to show up on this report. So states, of course, have these reports now. Most states do, and pretty soon every single state will. But we were creating our own report right in our software. So you could, right when you're talking to the patient and you're looking at their chart in our software, you could click a link and you could view this report right there rather than having to go out of our software and go to the state website and try to find the report there. So that's why it was an optional feature, because they had another option. So the bad news is when we first rolled this out, it was only available in 3 states. So that meant, again, I'm working with some low numbers to start. It's now available in a lot more states, 30 some odd states, right? So I'm going to redo this with the larger numbers and see how that goes. Again, we accidentally were measuring potential adopters as people that really had no reason to use this report. Pediatricians and allergists rarely prescribe controlled substances. But we were measuring them because we thought, oh, anybody could use this report. Lesson learned there. The good news is that Vince, the analytics manager, he was able to get me some great data that made it really easy to at least do the math around this. But again, a small data set because it was only available in 3 states, and he wasn't able to share his source data. He had it in some programming interface. I don't even know what it was. All right, let me show you the math behind some of this stuff. So I distilled this down to a bunch of true-false statements. So it's just basically binary stuff, right? Did anyone at that practice, anyone at that hospital, anyone at that doctor's office, did anyone read the documentation? Yes or no? How many read it? How many didn't? How many of those, again, I'm doing organization to organization, not user to user. How many of them adopted the feature? How many of them didn't adopt the feature? And then I'm looking at cross sections of that. Of those that read the documentation, how many adopted the feature? That's my holy grail, right? And then of those that didn't read the documentation, how many adopted the feature? I need that in order to do my math. And then, is there a correlation? Is this statistically significant? And that's where I needed my mathematician friend, Pierre Paolo, to help me figure that stuff out. All right, so let's look at the first feature, claim action ad attachments. So 120 organizations, client sites, read our documentation in the time frame that I looked at. Over 3,000 did not. Ouch. So 1,600 adopted the feature. Almost 1,800 did not adopt the feature. Of those that read the documentation, how many adopted the feature? Again, these are not users, they're organizations. 64 of them. Of those that didn't read the documentation, how many adopted the feature? More than 1,500. Don't ask me why that is. All right, so maybe this will help you explain things a little bit, help me explain things a little bit better to you, rather. So on the right, in the green, we're looking at readership. On the left, we're looking at usage of the feature, or adoption, as they like to call it in marketing. So to do the math, you just read through that top line there, right? So the non-reader adopters. So that's that number in the middle of the blue circle there, that 1,537. You divide that by all the people that didn't read the documentation. That was on my previous slide, but it's just the combination of those numbers. So that's 3,270. You get 47%. Then you combine that, you compare that to the next line, rather. Reader adopters, right? So that's your holy grail. Those are the folks that read the documentation and used the feature. That's what you're hoping to see, right? 64 of them did that. You divide that by all the people that read the documentation. The number, I have a laser pointer, don't I? Look at that. Divide that by the number on the top there, right? 120 that read the documentation, and you get 53%. So if you have 47% compared to 53%, are those numbers far enough apart to show a statistically significant, boy, that's hard to say, especially this late in the afternoon, correlation? And the answer is no. They're too close together. So we can't really show any strong correlation one way or the other there. Thank you. We're at 15 minutes? Okay. Good. We are getting close here. So we're good. All right. So we did the same thing with nursing flow sheets. So again, we only had like 92 small rural hospitals that we're looking at here. So how many of those hospitals read the document? How many didn't read the document? How many adopted the feature? How many didn't adopt the feature? Look at that, nice even number, 46, 46. Half and half. So then we look at the cross-section of those. We're like, okay, of those hospitals that read the documentation, how many actually used this nursing flow sheets feature? It was 18. And then of those that didn't, how many adopted the feature? 28. So again, this might be an easier way to digest all this. We just answer these questions. So how many of those hospitals were non-reader adopters? Didn't read the document, but did use the feature. 28 of them. You divide that by all the people that did not read the documentation, 49, and you come up with 57%. And then how many read the document and adopted the feature? That's 18, the number right in the middle of the Venn diagram there. Divide that by all the people that read the documentation, 43, and you come up with 42%. Again, is that statistically significant? No. Again, those numbers, 42 and 57, they're just too close together, especially when you're working with numbers this low. All right, last feature, prescription drug monitoring. Again, this was available in 3 states. How many people looked at this report instead of going to the state website and looking at the state report? So 361 of the doctor's offices read the documentation. 312 did not. 550 used the feature. 123 did not. And when you look at the cross-section, of those that read the documentation, how many used the feature? 351. Of those that didn't read the documentation, how many adopted the feature? 199. So our Venn diagram looks a lot different because there's a lot more overlap there. We have a much higher percentage in the middle of folks. That's our holy grail number, right? Those ones that read the documentation and used the feature. So you divide the 199 by the 312, all the people that didn't read the documentation, you come up with 64%. And then your holy grail number, that 351, you divide that by all the people that read the documentation, 361, you come up with 97%. Is that statistically significant? Yes, those numbers are very far apart. And you can say that there's definitely a strong correlation between the people that read the documentation and used the feature. So that's it. Those are the 3 features that I was actually able to actually run that whole process through. The other optional features I ran into all those other challenges I spelled out for you earlier. So that's as far as I've gotten to this point in time. So I've captured some preliminary data. As you saw, the quality and quantity of the data, not great in most cases. But that last one, the prescription drug monitoring, it gave me some really good insights in particular. So I have some promising signs there, and I feel like I have enough evidence to fight on. So, I said at the beginning, my goal was simply, are people that read documentation more likely to use a feature? Just yes or no. And even if the answer is no, this was a successful project, because at least I proved that, right? Or showed a strong correlation. But after going through spending the last year doing all this and talking it over with my team and my manager and my manager's manager, I decided, you know what, that's not my goal anymore. I've built my skateboard. I've kind of figured out how to do this, and I've made a lot of mistakes along the way. I've learned now, you know, what questions I need to ask. Now I just want to replicate my skateboard. I want to build that scooter now. I want to see if I can do this time and time again. If I can get, you know, a good number of features where I can show that correlation that I showed before, now I've got something, and now I can just keep, I want to just keep building. I'm not really actually that interested in answering the question all that much anymore. I just want to see how far I can take this thing. So I'm not discouraged despite all the challenges that I've laid out for you. You know, I made a lot of mistakes, but I learned a ton, more than I ever imagined. I still have a lot of support from my leadership to continue doing this. They're really excited about this work, actually. And they're trying to help me clear my calendar to make so I can have time to spend more time on doing this. So, you know, how am I going to learn? How am I going to use what I've learned, rather? Now I know what the ideal feature looks like, you know, now that I've seen all these unideal features. Is that a word? So now I can present a compelling case when I go to these scrum teams. I can say, hey, you should be measuring adoption of this feature you're building right now, you know, and you should define exactly what is adoption. You should be measuring that. And now I know what questions to ask them. You know, before I thought, I just ask them if it's optional or not, and that was good enough for me, right? But now I know, like, who is your target audience? Are you sure it's exactly these types of users? You know, are you sure there aren't other ways to use this feature than just the way you're expecting it to be used, you know? I can ask those right questions, and I can try to replicate my success. So if I were King Arthur looking for the Holy Grail, and I could use divine intervention, I would say that scrum teams have to be accountable for adoption. It's not just guidance. I'm hoping that leadership will eventually force scrum teams to say, you know what? It's not an option anymore. You've got to define adoption. You've got to measure adoption. You need to be accountable for making sure that people are using those features that we're paying you to build, you know. I would also implement some tools that would make it a lot easier for us all to share data with each other, the scrum teams and the tech writing team and all that. And of course, I'd spend lots of money on those really fancy tools that are out there that can capture data right at the source rather than going and pulling data from some database that's way downstream from when the actions are actually taking place. And I'd try to, of course, automate the whole thing. So this is my final slide here, and then I will open it up to questions. So as you can see, I'm much closer to the beginning than the middle of this journey. You know, I've spent a long time on this already, but now each step is easier. Now I feel like I can make really big strides in short time. And this will probably be part of my job for years to come. And again, like I said at the beginning, you know, there are big potential gains to me having some success with this. You know, we could save the company money if we make sure that we're spending the money in the right places on features that people are actually using. And if I can show that our documentation is encouraging people to use those features and that people are finding more value in those features because of what they read in our documentation, that, of course, would help garner some recognition for our team and can help me when it comes to staffing needs. And it might boost my career. We'll see. Again, hasn't happened yet. That is all from me. How much time do we have for questions? Okay, and I'm happy to stay late, too, if anybody wants to as well. So, fire away. Yes, please.
So, how do people access it?
All right, so the question for those that couldn't hear was, our help, is it contextual help, or what was the second part? Right, or is it just a link that someone clicks on, right, yeah. So our online help, which is what I talked about in yesterday's presentation, is contextual, is context sensitive. but this release documentation is not. This release documentation is just all, it's just one, it's just a link that people click. So they can write in our, they have to log into our software, and they can click a link right there on the homepage to go read the release documentation, but it, we just serve up the HTML5 tri-pane output right there as a separate window. We also put that link on our community site, which is single sign-on to our software as well. Does that answer your question? Is that, yeah, great. What other questions do you guys have? Yes? Yes.
Has that knowledge changed the way you're now creating that documentation and other tools?
What a great question. Boy, you just teed it up. How many people here are going to LavaCon in October? Nobody? Nobody's going to LavaCon? Oh. Because Samantha Barney up front here and I are going to be presenting on exactly the answer to that question. So the question was, for those that couldn't hear, was the release trainer model, this fact that only one person from a practice, a medical practice with thousands of users, is actually going and reading the release training materials and our release notes and documentation, and then turning around and training all of the other users. So that train the trainer model you hear people talk about, right? Has that impacted the way that we write our documentation and produce what we give to our clients, prepare clients for releases? And the answer is yes in spades. So much so that we're doing a presentation about it at LavaCon, a tech writing conference in Portland in October. So Matt up front here, the world's tallest technical writer, Samantha Barney, and a lot of other folks on my team, we put our heads together and we worked very closely with a team at Athena Health called Customer Marketing. We work very closely with, who else do we work closely with? Product Education. They create the e-learning at Athena Health. And I'm forgetting people. But in any case, a lot of other teams. And we created this thing called the Release Training Package. And so it is a zip file. And in that zip file, it has all of our release documentation. Like I said, we might produce 100 essentially help topics, right, that are on what's coming in the new release. So it has all that documentation in PDF format, in long form, as well as it divided up by role, by user role. So like I said, we have doctors and nurses and billers and front desk staff and things like that, right? So we'll break up the documentation. We'll say, these are all the, you know, features that are being released in the next release that apply to doctors. And these are all the ones that apply to billers. And we break them up into separate PDFs. And then we found out that the vast majority of those release trainers at practices were creating PowerPoint presentations. They were taking the headline, one of our screenshots, and the intro text and throwing that on a PowerPoint slide and then creating a PowerPoint presentation and having a big meeting and showing it off them. And we asked them, when we found this out, like I said, Samantha did a bunch of surveys to our clients, and when they told us this, we said, could you send us some examples? So they emailed them to us, and we looked at them, we're like, this is crazy. So we're like, well, we could do that. So we do that. So, you know, actually, Matt does the majority of this. So we do that now. So now, when our release documentation is complete, then, you know, Matt and Sam and I will sit down, and we'll just take all our headlines and all our, the key screenshot and the intro text and a couple of bullets and whatever. And we stick them on a PowerPoint slide and we create all these different PowerPoint decks. And we even break up the PowerPoint decks by role. So this is the PowerPoint deck for the billers and this is the PowerPoint deck for the doctors and all that. What else do we put in the zip files? Email templates, right. So we found out that we asked them, how do you communicate with all the folks that you're training? And they said, oh, we do that by email. So we created these generic templates that are like, hey, the new release is coming out on this date, and you know, these are the things you're gonna need to know, and here's a link to the release documentation, and here's a link to the community site, and all that stuff. So we put those in Microsoft Word, and we just include those in there as well. And our PowerPoint deck, on each slide, we put a link to the full release note, those are big, like 20-page, you know, pieces of documentation. And we put a link to any e-learning that we have that for the release as well, release training that we offer up as e-learning. We do these, our e-learning team does these 2 to 3 minute click-through walkthrough videos of the new features. So we'll link to those as well. And then a grid, a feature grid, right? So we found out one of our clients created this grid every release. He would go through all our release documentation, and he would create this grid. And on the top of the grid in the columns, he would have roles. He would have billers and doctors and whatever. And then then he would have our products. And he would say, this feature that's being released, it affects this product and it affects this type of user. And this feature affects this product and this type of user. And he would show the intersection of those, right? So now we create a feature grid. We create it in PowerPoint and we create it in Word and we do a PDF of it too. And we throw all this in a zip file and we post that zip file up on our community site. And then we try to figure out who all these trainers are. We keep surveying them and asking them to give us their email addresses and all that. And then we blast them, and we're like, hey, the release training package is up. Go get it. And we have surveyed them. We've done this 3 releases now, and we've surveyed them, and they love it to death. It's like the greatest thing since sliced bread. They just are so happy about it. Yeah, it's been really great. Big success. So thank you for that question. I apologize for the super long-winded answer. Okay, other questions? What else? Anything? No? That's it. All right. How are we doing on time? Are we up? Oh, we do have a question. Sorry.
So you showed an example
of your release notes. Mm-hmm.
So how does the note that maybe 27 pages long
to what your actual documentation is? Oh. So at Athena Health, our actual documentation is our online help. We don't have any user guides or anything like that. It's cloud-based, so there's no installation. There's no installation guides. Is that what you were getting at? Right, right.
My company, we don't do that, but we pretty much just create the release
notes
that are 4 sentences or whatever.
Right, industry standard, yeah.
Not even lengthy. But in the past, I've done it something more similar to what you're doing, like a longer document, so technically there's no more about the topic or something to happen.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm just wondering how is, you have these release notes, but is it like a more traditional release
note
type thing, or is it a summary, or is it...
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to put it up here in a new topic section or whatever.
Right. Right, correct. Yeah, so the question was, are the release documentation that I've been talking about this whole time and that I was measuring readership of, is that a summary of some larger form documentation? And the answer is no. It is, yeah, it is everything. It is soup to nuts. Yeah, if you're releasing a brand new feature like nursing flow sheets, for example, yeah, it's a 27-page thing that just spells out everything you ever needed to know about this brand new feature. It's essentially the online help for it before there is online help for it, because we're publishing this 3 weeks before the release. So then Gail sitting up front here, she spends those 3 weeks taking all that documentation and updating the online help and adding all that content in. Yeah. So does that answer your question? Is that, yeah. Sure, yeah, of course. Any other questions? Matt?
Can you talk about tiering? Because I could go right
off. Tiering, yeah, that's a good point. That's right. So remember I showed that graphic that showed how we had that big spike in customer service calls after our release last November, not last November, but November of 2017. And then, you know, we decreased it. And I said that Sam up front here, she surveyed all of our clients, and we made a bunch of changes to our release documentation in response to that. One of the giant changes that we made was we used to create one of those big long form topics for every single change to our software, whether it was just, you know, a new field or it was a whole new feature. Of course, it wasn't 27 pages long, it'd be 1 page long or something, but still, we would give it the whole full treatment, no matter how big or small the change was. And what we decided we would try out early in 2018, in our first release, was producing, we decided we'd call them Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3 release notes. So Tier 1 would be like the ones I've been talking about, these big, long form, whole new topic for a whole new feature kind of thing, a whole thing soup to nuts. Tier two would be a feature that was, this is a modification to an existing feature. There's some significant changes though. And so we would have screenshots and numbered steps and all that, but we might not have a lot of explanation and we might not have all the data that I was showing you in that other screenshot, like 95% of the beta users found this benefit and have quotes and all. We wouldn't do that in the tier two ones. We'd only do that in those tier one example. And then tier three, it's literally just a little table. That's just a summary table. It's like, here's the change. We have this new field. Here's what that field does. And here's who this applies to. If you're a doctor and you're a biller, this applies to you. And this is all you need to know. And that's it. And so maybe like a more traditional release note, except in table format. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Matt. I don't know if that was helpful at all. But, any other questions? Well, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.